Well, hello, Norma Garcia. How are you?
I'm good, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. It's a beautiful day today, so no complaints, and get to learn a little bit about some of your work, some recent work as well, but a little bit about some of the, years of experience that you have both with Meta, and then also being an attorney. So anyway, I would love to kind of dive in. Today, folks, we're going to hear from Norma Garcia, my friend, and a little bit about her work at Meta, which she'll explain what Mission Economic Development Association is. Is that
Agency.
okay?
That's
Agency, sorry. And
okay.
then what it was like to testify before Congress. Like, that's amazing. So that's pretty cool. And talk about kind of the cashless society. What that looks like, why is it a good thing? Why is it not a good thing, especially for low-income communities, people of color? So we're going to talk a little bit about that, and kind of social justice in general. So anyway, Norma, I have met you several times, but I'd love to, if you could just share a little bit about your background, and then we'll hear a little bit about Meta as well. But if you can just share a little bit about your background, that would be great.
Sure, absolutely. So my name is Norma Garcia, and my title is Policy Counsel, Director of Advocacy at Mission Economic Development Agency, also known as Meta. Meta is an institution in San Francisco. We've been around, I think, 48 years now. We're about to
Wow.
celebrate the 48th anniversary.
Wow.
And the goal of Meta is to support the Latino immigrant community, originally in the Mission District, but as the community has moved to other neighborhoods, and actually even other towns, we continue to provide services for the community and to advocate for community interests. And so I am originally from the Mission District in San Francisco,
Latina.
Latina, San Francisco native.
There we
Both
are.
my parents were immigrants from Mexico,
Okay.
settled in San Francisco in the 1940s.
Wow.
We lived in the Mission, all the time I was a little kid. My parents were both, blue collar workers, union workers. And at that time, if you were a blue collar worker with a union job, you could actually afford to buy a home in the Mission. And so
Not
that's the Mission I remember, a time when there were lots of jobs and lots of opportunity. And
now. Was it all Latino back
no, it was
then?
not. There were many Latinos in the Mission District, but the Mission District, I would say a predominant characteristic was blue collar workers. Of all stripes. And my neighbors were, from all parts of the world.
Cool.
We all went to the same schools. Our parents all worked in manufacturing or, light industry of some sort. And we lived well together in the neighborhood.
I know the neighborhoods have kind of changed. And back in the day, what the Castro was mostly Irish, I think.
Yeah, I think the Castro has gone through various iterations of who predominates in the neighborhood. But one thing I'll say about San Francisco that I think rings true today is that it's always been a city, a welcoming city, people from other places. And
Well, and
that's,
yes and no, right? So, I mean, it's tough to live here in San Francisco because of the cost, and we're going to get into that momentarily. But going back to Meta, so obviously Meta doesn't only do advocacy. Can you just explain a little bit about the organization itself?
sure. Well, Meta began primarily as a nonprofit organization helping small businesses in the Mission District and helping small businesses with business strategy, helping them get financing and to develop their abilities as prosperous small businesses. And as time went on, it turned out that the people we were serving, the owners of those businesses, had other needs. They needed to build their financial capability for their families. They began to need things like housing assistance, some other forms of economic community development. And Meta began to help with that. Meta started out as a small organization. I think maybe there were six employees in the beginning, and now we're close to, I think, almost 100.
Awesome.
And that's, been over the years that development has happened. But Meta has evolved to meet the needs of the community that we serve. And I would think maybe one of the big milestones of Meta in the last 10 years has been the establishment of the Community Real Estate Division. Which was established in 2014, specifically to respond to the level of displacement that was happening in the Latino community in the Mission District. So it's not just like looking at, oh my God, this thing is happening. It's like, how can we be a solution? Well, a solution is being a developer of affordable housing to retain the current population and to hopefully reverse displacement that has happened among the community. And the Community Real Estate Division now has, I think it's over 1,200 units in its portfolio. Awesome. A number of those units are new developments. Mm-hmm. A number of those units are preserved affordable housing from existing housing. And some other, I think it's RAD housing, which was rehabilitated federal housing.
Yeah, I think that was the public housing program. Is that right?
Yeah.
And just curious, I want to move the conversation to hearing a little bit more about your experience and your work with Meta around this cashless society and what that looks like. And again, pros and cons, but really understanding the issues that low-income folks face. But if you could briefly maybe talk a little bit about the affordable housing portfolio and how do you square the idea of doing the preservation play with fair housing laws? Like how can Meta balance that? And maybe that's not the right question because I know you're not head of housing, but great. And we want to see, you know, the Latino population stay. But how does that work with fair housing?
Yeah. So we're very cognizant of fair housing laws and everything we do is in conformity with fair housing. We are a Latino focused organization, but we serve everyone.
Yeah.
And when you go to our housing developments, you'll see that there is a great mix of individuals from throughout San Francisco who live in the housing that we've built and the housing that we've preserved.
Yeah.
And so you'll see that. And
with
that comes a strengthening of the community, of the low-income sector, of low and moderate income sector of the community, which is really important to preserving the community diversity and the flavor of the neighborhoods that everyone loves, right?
Right.
So we were very aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Just wondering how that all works. And just going back a little bit, just to your background, Norma, can you just give us a little bit of your bio? Because it's a fascinating one.
So I am from the Mission District and I'm an attorney. Yeah. I am a graduate of UC Hastings Law School in San Francisco, a proud Legal Educational Opportunity Program, LEOP graduate.
Okay.
I graduated from law school in 1982.
Okay.
So I've been out for a while.
Yeah.
I went to Consumers Union, the nonprofit publisher of Consumer Reports magazine, for the bulk of my career. I spent 24 years there as an attorney advocating for consumer interests around financial services issues. And particularly my focus was around issues that impacted low to moderate income consumers. I would say a great area of focus for me was working on predatory mortgage lending practices, which is work that I started in the 90s. And it wasn't until 2010 that we got to see, you know, what the systemic failures of not addressing the consumer issues in that area really produced.
Mm. And was that, I forget the person's name. I think her last name is Obayashi. Is that right? Maybe maybe that doesn't ring a bell, but anyway.
Yeah, no, sorry.
Yeah. So fascinating attorney working in the sector and rights issues for literally decades. And thank you for your work and lifting it up for so many. So thank you for that. But I'd love to hear a little bit about this testimony you did with Congress. So if you could just kind of set the stage, what was it? And then kind of we'll dive into that.
Yeah, absolutely. So just that piggybacks on my background at Consumers Union, where I spent all those years working in legislative and regulatory advocacy.
Okay.
The great bulk of my work was in the California legislature representing consumer interests on behalf of Consumers Union. So I'm very experienced at that type of work and testifying before legislative bodies on various issues.
So you've done that multiple times?
Thousands.
Thousands of times.
Only twice. This is my second time before Congress, but I've testified before the California legislature thousands of times.
Okay. Wow. Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. Awesome. Well, So, okay, so let's hear about this experience before Congress. What,
Yeah,
like, how did
so
it all happen? What was the issue? Set the stage, please.
yeah, I got an invitation from the House Committee on Financial Services to speak on this issue of the impact of a cashless society on vulnerable communities. And it really does sort of piggyback on my work as a consumer advocate in financial services all those years, and really leverages my experience with Meta, where for the last 4 years I've been focused on work that impacts the specific community we serve and communities like ours.
Yeah.
And so it really tapped into the idea of, well, what would be the impact, not just for individuals, but even for the small businesses that we help? And when you think about it, the idea of not being able to use cash at a retail establishment, brick and mortar retail establishment, maybe it's kind of convenient for some people, but for the community we serve, it's actually kind of confusing. You know, like, why wouldn't my money be accepted? And in addition to sort of those sort of practical mechanical issues, there are sort of psychological issues too, particularly when you're talking about a community that is already experiencing a lot of displacement. If you go into an
Now I
establishment,
don't even want your money.
they don't even want my money, and I'm willing to pay for something. You know, like that kind of messes with your psyche. And so, you know, when I testified about this, I really encouraged them to, number one, ask the right questions, who's being impacted, and number two, think about the practical implications of not accepting cash, both physically and psychologically, as well as what does this mean for small businesses that prefer to deal in cash? There are a number of small businesses that really don't want to worry about paying the interchange fee when someone swipes a card. And
3%,
they'd rather,
4%.
pass on the savings to the consumer, to their
Right.
customer, to keep their prices low rather than having to raise their prices to cover for that expense.
Or God forbid the small business owner makes a penny or two.
Exactly. So, I mean, there are a lot of valid reasons why cash needs to remain as a viable currency for these sorts of transactions. And you know, for me, it was bigger than just kind of the physical manifestation of cash. It's the whole notion of as we examine ideas that are innovative, we need to always ask the question, how are people going to be impacted negatively? It's not just, oh wow, I have this shiny idea and you know it's really great because it's innovative and I think you all should love me for it. It's not that. It's like, have you asked yourself, the first question is, how is this going to impact the most vulnerable population? And if you haven't done that, then really you haven't done your market analysis. You haven't done your research. Because I believe, and I think a lot of people I work with believe, that if we are really going to move to a more equitable society, that always has to be the first point of analysis in any idea. And this is an issue that we're pushing a lot because this is top of mind for so many, and this is a moment. And are we really doing this, right?
Well, I want to pick up on a couple of things you said. So I always wonder is, you know, one, what is the unintended consequence or consequences, right? Because, you know, it's like, yay, cashless society. Okay, that's going to be cheaper and easier or whatever. And then it's like, then you implement whatever program it is. And it's like, rah, rah, we didn't think this through. So, so understanding what the unintended consequences are, which I think we're saying the same thing. But it's interesting also to try to square it with innovation, right? And so a lot of the work that we do is with foundations, as you well know, and they're always pushing this idea of innovation. So it's just interesting that sometimes, you know, like, yes, and of course we live in Silicon Valley-esque, right? Where innovation happens every day and making our lives hopefully easier or sometimes. But sometimes, you know, again, you have to really think it through and understand it from a different perspective.
Oh, I think that's right. And I think there's a fascination with innovation. That's not a bad thing, because innovation can really be very beneficial for society, and it has proven to be so, right? I think the bigger question is innovation for whom? And then the other question, the elephant in the room is, have you asked yourself that hard question, who's going to be negatively impacted? And if you don't know, then you need to have other people at the table to have that discussion with you, right? So connection with impacted communities is absolutely vital. Their voice at the table, at the front end, not as an afterthought, right? That's really important too.
And that was your role, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of our role. And part of my role as the policy counsel and director of advocacy at Meta is to insert ourselves and make sure that we're at those tables, and figure out where those tables are, and then get there.
And so how do you know where those tables are and where these decisions are being made, and knock, knock? And sometimes it's, you know, being having a seat at the table, but sometimes you don't even know where the room is.
Yeah, well, in the legislative arena, it's a little easier.
Okay.
Because, you know, I'm very familiar with the processes and the players.
Right.
And, you know, picking up the phone and saying, hey, we want to be in this discussion, it's not a hard thing.
And are most committees open to that and saying, like, okay, and you say, look, I'm representing Meta, da, da, da.
Yeah, absolutely. And Meta is a registered California lobbyist employer.
Okay.
And we have five staff members who are registered California lobbyists, and I'm one of them.
Okay.
So we are very much participants in this process, and we have to do all our regular reporting like every other lobbying entity. But we use those channels. And then we get calls too. So we get calls from legislators on the local and on the state level and their staff who want to know what we think. So I think we've done a very good job of raising our profile as a credible organization with whom to have these conversations.
But it also sounds like that the system works too. If they're actually reaching out to you and saying, or whoever, looking for an opinion, or how low-income communities or Latino or whatever communities are being affected or could be affected, to me, that's like, yay, democracy is working, and or kind of. Yes.
Well, I think yes and no. I mean, we have the capacity as an organization, both with staffing and skill, to do this. But not every organization that deserves to be there has this capacity, and they're not necessarily going to be get the calls, or, you know, be there at the hearings, or be able to travel to Sacramento to be present at these hearings. I mean, this takes a lot of resources, and so. And so every organization deserves to be adequately resourced to perform this role as well. It shouldn't just be, you know, one or two or three organizations. And the reason I say this too, Mark, is because when the going gets rough, it is incredibly taxing for a single organization or two organizations or even a coalition of organizations to achieve the kind of representation and influence that we deserve compared to the moneyed interest. Like, we're always swimming upstream.
Right.
And whether it was in my years as a consumer advocate, you know, fighting for a more fair marketplace for consumers in general on a whole variety of topics, or the work that I do through Meta, which is about economic sufficiency for our neighborhood and others like ours, we're still under-resourced compared to the interest on the other side.
And, well, yeah, and so, but Meta is receiving, I assume Meta receives funding from foundation or fundraising or something, or maybe it's just a mix from different development fees or something to support this work, because it sounds so important to raise these issues and hire folks like you and others to educate policymakers.
Well, in general, it's very hard to raise funds from foundations to support lobbying.
Right, of course.
That's another area that you know, could really use some work, because if we really want to support community self-determination and the system for achieving greater self-determination requires you to lobby.
Right.
We need to figure out ways around supporting that work. And that's an issue that is something that lots of organizations are experiencing. Unless you're an organization that has a product that can then support and fund the lobbying work, you're at a disadvantage. And there aren't many organizations like that, right?
That
fall into that description.
Right.
So there are investments that organizations make at the expense of other programmatic areas in order to support this very kind of work.
Right. And then what the organization has to decide, is that the best and highest and best use for those funds? And well, going back to the congressional hearing, what was it like? And were you, you know, were you nervous? Like, did they share questions beforehand? And how did it all work? Or was it you just like doing like a 10 minute, like, hey, don't forget to think about, you know, low income folks?
Yeah, so I got the call about a week before the hearing, and had a conversation with staff, and we discussed my interest and my knowledge in this area, and why you know, why the work I do now would be relevant to the hearing, and the discussion at the hearing. I was asked to write written testimony, which I've done in the past many times. So. I put my testimony together very quickly. And then from that testimony, I distilled it to my talking points.
Got it.
I had 5 minutes
okay.
to present. And I was planning to stay within that 5 minutes, but apparently I went over by like 30 seconds.
Wow.
So, but that's how it worked. Was I nervous? Well, you know, I've done this a lot, but you know, you still feel nerves. Like that's
yeah,
kind of a good adrenaline.
Right.
It
right,
keeps
right.
you moving, and it keeps your mind sharp.
Yeah.
And you know, it keeps your heart beating nice and strong, and your feet tapping while you're, you know, under the table and everything smooth on top.
Oh, wait, 5 minutes. Like, let's hear about, like, you know, the impact of poor people for 5 minutes. Go.
Well, it's let's talk about the topic that is this topic of this hearing, and tell us why, you know, you think certain things are true, why we should pay attention to certain things as part of this discussion. Mm-hmm. And it was my opportunity to explain some of the things we've talked about cashless society and even innovation, and, you know, mm-hmm. some things that may not even thought about, you know, things as practical issues, like, you know, we're having power outages in California,
right.
and it's happening mm-hmm. a lot. And you can't just go to a store and buy something with a card when there's a power outage. You can't fill up your gas tank with a card when there's a power outage.
Right.
Merchants can't transact in power outages unless they accept cash, you know? And so, you know, that's kind of like on a practical level, really, when you think about the national application of that thought, it's quite broad because we're experiencing natural disasters all over this country.
Yeah.
Right. And increasingly so. And so, like, let's think about these things. Right.
This is what do you think were the most salient points that you made that represent the low income population?
That the idea of their cash not being accepted is
the mental piece.
Yeah. It's physically weird. You know, it's like, wait a minute, this is money.
Right. Right?
It's psychologically traumatic.
Right.
If you're already feeling like you don't belong, here's another example of where you don't belong, that it's unnecessary.
Right.
Because cash is still cash, right?
Cash is king, as they say at banks.
Yeah. And I was just sort of wondering, why are we having this conversation? Is there something wrong with cash that I don't know about?
Right. Hmm. But then, you know, just to kind of switch the argument, just to play devil's advocate here, Sweden. I believe is a cashless society or trying to move towards that.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't, you know, imploded. So how do you, I suspect somebody asked about, you know, other areas of the world that are considering this.
They didn't, but from what I know about this, more on the periphery, it's the kind of thing where if you're going to go there, you do it in steps. Right. It's not just like today we're cash, tomorrow we're cashless.
Right.
There is a certain level of time that people need to adopt these new systems. And if you're going to make it successful, you do it incrementally. And you make sure that everybody has access to the technology that it takes to do this.
Yeah.
That people are supported with the infrastructure that they need to not have to bear the additional expense that maybe they don't have a phone, or they don't top up their minutes. You know, like these things are.
Or they may not have a bank account.
Exactly. These could all be practical impediments. And so some of these countries do a better job of making sure that these systems are available to everyone at a, you know, fairly low cost. And when you have an infrastructure like that and you've built in a timeline to bill adoption, you know, you maybe can get there successfully. We're not
Right.
that country.
Right.
We're not
Right, right,
there
right.
yet.
Yeah. And so I assume so you provide your testimony and then you receive questions. I'm just curious, things are just so political right now, so I have to ask this. Were there general themes that you saw from the Democratic side versus the Republican side, or how did that work?
You know, I didn't sense that this issue was terribly controversial. I think that my experience was that the questions that were asked of all the members asked were really more kind of fact-finding. I didn't feel like anyone was really staking their turf.
But someone's clearly bringing this issue up. Like it didn't like land from nowhere, right? There was a hearing because somebody's pushing it.
I think it came up because there's been legislation, some state level and some local legislation that has actually banned the idea of cashless. So,
Oh, interesting.
yeah, so San Francisco, and I think this is another reason why I was invited, San Francisco passed an ordinance that that requires brick and mortar business establishments to take cash as legal tender for sales, right? And the state of Colorado did something similar. And the representative from the state of Colorado who sponsored the legislation in Colorado was one of the witnesses, and he explained what they did and why they did it for very similar reasons.
Right.
So is there a need for this in other states? Potentially. I would say that if we start to see a prevalence of these practices propping up kind of everywhere, then I think, yeah, maybe we should talk about more statewide, multi-state legislation, or maybe even federal legislation to address this. And they're considering federal legislation. And so they wanted to know more about the experience in local jurisdictions and in
Interesting.
states.
Okay, cool. Thanks for I didn't know that. So this issue of a cashless society is just one that affects literally billions of people, but in California, whether it's San Francisco or the Bay Area, how do you start thinking, or how do you personally start thinking about policy issues? Kind of a big question, as it relates to low income people of color, et cetera, different socioeconomic classes, and how do you even start thinking about how to think about it?
Well, let's just say there are so many issues that pop up in that world
Yeah.
that it's almost like I can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, when I exist in this world and I see how certain things work, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, how does that impact a community? And it can be something that could be relatively unnoticed by most people,
Sure.
but I'm always thinking like, wow, what difference is that going to make? You know, what
Right.
difference is that going to make? And it could be something as seemingly innocent as you know, red lanes for buses on Mission Street, and
Right.
what that's done to the commercial corridor and the kind
Yeah.
of merchants that we help support. You know, it's things like that. I'm looking at this going, wow, some of these big kind of in your face thing. And then there's practices of different industries and interest that perpetuate the status quo and continue to harm people of color and people who are low income in many different neighborhoods. And some of this is, you know, these are remnants of racism and generations of racism, and slavery, quite frankly. And some of it is just sort of like somebody didn't think hard enough about it, you know. So there's a lot, you know. And in my world, I'm always looking at that. It's
Yeah.
just kind of my orientation, and it's a
And
lot because of my experience and who I am and the communities that I advocate for and care about.
what are some of the, and thank you. What are some of the big issues that you're focused on now, Norma? What does that look like? I'm sure housing is one, but what does it look like in kind of on your top list of concerns?
So housing is certainly one, and housing is a subset of a larger issue of displacement, and the importance of cultural placekeeping and keeping neighborhoods whole. So because I work at Meta, I get to focus a lot on the Mission District, which I've seen, you know, changing over the years, in some ways good, in some ways not. And the idea of working very hard to ensure that the Latino community continues to thrive in the neighborhood, that, you know, the neighborhood doesn't become a Latino Disneyland where we're all, you know, cast members in a show, is really important to me. And it's something that I get to do a lot in my work at Meta. We get to focus on issues that help families succeed with their children in schools, so the children can grow up healthy and educated. We get to work with the small businesses to keep the economic status strong in our community. We get to work on housing, which is clearly, you know, preserving existing housing, but building new housing. I mean, if you go on the Mission now,
preserving is one thing, building is a whole nother.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
And we have a long ways to go still. So these are just a few of the things, that the issue areas that I get to work on with my colleagues at Meta and our allied organizations.
But how cool to have grown up and support the community that you care about. And that's
really cool, Mark. I feel very privileged to have come full circle with all the experience that I got in my previous job, and all that to my work at Meta, and to work with the great people that I get to work with. You know, I've learned so much from my colleagues at Meta. And I'll tell you, one area that's huge is land use and zoning.
Oh yeah.
And making sure that the decisions that happen in that area really do incorporate equity as the first line of analysis.
Well, do you, so to that point, do you see that equity and DEI work is coming more into the discussion, or is it just like,
That's a really good question. You know, it's a really good question, because the first reaction I have is my entire life has been focused around that.
Yeah.
And the rest of the world finally caught up. You know, like, it's not, you know, of the people I know, the people I work with and have worked with for many years, this has been our battle cry for decades. And
but we're also insulated too, right? We all are talking about equity issues. I guess my question is, do you feel like it's starting to permeate into the conversations that you're having at different tables?
Absolutely.
Like, is there hope for us, Norma?
Absolutely. And I think it's not only a moral imperative, it's actually a political imperative now. Mm-hmm. I think it's the last part that really tipped it.
Do you think it's an economic piece too?
Piece, it always has been. But I think what has been missing is the recognition, number one, that it's a moral imperative. And number two, what's really happened now is that it's become a political imperative, so that if you are in the position where you make decisions and you don't consider these things, it's actually a liability for you.
Yeah.
Right. And so now there is more reaching out to those of us who talk about this and do something about, have been for a long time. How do I do this? You know what that's like. You're getting the calls. I want to do this. How do I do it? So here's my feeling about this. However you get to this realization, I'm not going to judge you on that. I'm just glad you're there.
Yeah.
Let's move forward.
Yeah.
Because we could spend a lot of time talking about, you know, what didn't happen and why.
Right.
We know that history.
Right.
We don't have time to spend.
Fast forward.
We need traction.
Yeah.
So let's do it.
Yeah. Well, so to that point then, maybe kind of the closing question I have, again, you know, thank you for all of your work. And it sounds literally decades, despite it not looking so, but however, I guess my question is, you know, to younger people, how do they become advocates for their community? How do they become the next Norma Garcia, or you know, whatever advocate or leader you want to say? What would you say, especially maybe for low income folks, maybe for you know, immigrants, women, non-binary, whatever? What advice do you have for them?
I think first recognize that we are all natural born advocates. You know, from the moment we're born, how do we get fed? We know how to
Right.
ask for what we need.
Yeah,
So you already
that's
have a big
good.
chunk of that inside of you. It's innate. And
Yeah.
the other thing is to understand what the needs of your community are, and you'll know when you've lived it, you'll know what that is. And that's incredible knowledge. You can't learn that from books. And so you already have an advantage over people who didn't have that experience.
Right.
And then polish that with education and go out and get the best education you can get. It's not absolutely necessary, but boy, it doesn't hurt. You know, it really helps a lot. I think certainly work in community-based organizations. Consider working for national and maybe even international organizations so that you learn the full scope of advocacy across many different venues. It builds your confidence. It builds your ability to connect the dots when you see things that seem random and suddenly you can plug them together and like, this is not random. Here's how it connects. I highly recommend getting a degree in public policy and or public policy slash law, or if you do any other discipline, consider learning about policy because and how it works and how you can change systems by leveraging policy advocacy. I think that, you know, my mother used to say to me, she says, you know, you belong everywhere.
Nice.
And that advice just, you know, it just carried me. And I would say that to anyone who is considering doing this work, remember, you belong everywhere.
Awesome.
And so
Awesome.
I'll leave with that bit. You know, I always, you know, give a lot of kudos to my mom.
Yeah,
Really
she
gave
sounds cool.
she was, you know, my mom was a seamstress and she was about 5 feet tall. She was, you know, just an amazing woman, but she was also a union organizer.
Wow.
And she was an activist seamstress, I like to say.
Awesome.
You know, she's my inspiration. So I like to pass that along to other people because I like to keep her memory alive. She's been gone for many years. And it gives me a lot of pride to be able to do that. So
That's
I'm going to do
great.
that.
Yay. Norma, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. Thanks for all the work that you do on
Thank you,
behalf
Mark.
of all of our city residents. We appreciate that and beyond. What a delight. Thank you. And thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Mark.